Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, fj@offbeatoregon.com, your host for today's Offbeat Oregon History Podcast episode. Thanks for downloading, and I sure hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on August 3rd of 2014 under the headline, Tillamook Burn Blew Up with Shocking Speed. Here we go. Perhaps the most interesting part of the story of Oregon's Tillamook Burn of 1933 is not what happened, but what didn't happen. 3 decades before the Tillamook Burn, the wildfire known as the Yakult Burn, really dozens of simultaneous fires all across Oregon and Washington, lit into the states with savage ferocity and blinding speed. It engulfed whole towns, destroyed sawmills, and chased frantic loggers out of doomed camps, and it chased down 35 people and burned them alive. On the great grim day of August 24, 1933, the Tillamook fire moved with even greater speed, and there were thousands of people, firefighters and residents, at risk of fiery death as it raced down upon them. Yet although one firefighter was killed by a falling tree, not a single person was burned to death in the 1933 blaze. According to historian Stuart Holbrook, who was there that day, the survivors have Lynn Cronemiller, the chief forester for the Oregon Department of Forestry, to thank for this. On the morning of Thursday, August 24th, 1933, Oregon wildland firefighters weren't unduly concerned about the large forest fire that was eating into Tillamook and Clatsop counties from the east. It was a big, hairy forest fire, but nothing too out of the ordinary for that time of year. They hoped to contain it within the next day or two at 40,000 acres. A big burn, sure, but yeah, all in a day's work. By noon, everything had changed, and everyone knew they were dealing with something completely new, with a 500,000-acre fiery monster that would leave its scars on the state for the next 100 years. Already it had a name, the Tillamook Burn. For many people on the fire lines, the first word of what was to come was a phone call. It was Cronemiller, and he wanted everybody off the fire lines on the west side of the burn immediately. Then Cronemiller sent drivers racing out through the back roads in the Coast Range west of the fire with orders to get the word to every rancher, woodsman, and hiker in the area, out, now. Their belongings hurriedly stuffed into automobiles and trucks, the residents obeyed, and as they hastened to safety through the thickening smoke, they found themselves racing with herds of wildlife, deer and elk, galloping along the roadway where the going was easiest, heedless of the danger of hunters. Cronemiller that morning had seen the signs, and he knew what they meant. Humidity at 26%, almost a record low for the region at daybreak. Little puffs of hot wind coming out of the east and gaining strength as the day continued, bringing air fresh from the sun-baked plains of central Oregon. And a big, out-of-control forest fire still burning in the crowns of 63 square miles of big old-growth fir trees. The conditions were perfect for a worst-case scenario, what wildland firefighters call a blow-up. And if that happened, the fire would move much faster than a fire crew could run or even drive. There were by now 3,000 men battling the fire, and most of them were in its path, trying to stop its progress by digging and cutting fire lines. Hundreds, maybe thousands of them would die horribly if they didn't get out. It happened just a little later that morning. 50 miles away in Portland, residents soon were gawking at the massive mushroom-shaped cloud that hung towering over the valley to the east, 2 miles high and dozens of miles wide. Beneath that cloud, hurricane-strength winds howled, driven by the intense heat of hundreds of thousands of acres of burning old-growth firs. Whole burning limbs and treetops soared into the sky and were blown toward the sea, where they rained down on beachside communities and even fishing boats. The men weren't able to do much more than just stay a safe distance away. By that night, the fire was burning more than 270,000 acres and looked to be unstoppable. But a little later, the hot east wind died down and was replaced with a moist breeze off the ocean and a fog bank. And with the help of this cloud of moisture, firefighters finally were able to slow the fire's race to the sea and contain it behind fire lines and bring the fire down out of the crowns of the trees. After that day, the fire settled to a slow crawl toward the sea, and firefighters managed to keep it out of the Crowns until it was finally stopped for good by the early onset of the fall rains a week or two later. The Great Fire hadn't destroyed the trees. It had merely killed them, leaving them standing as massive snags that every summer got drier and more flammable. Knowing what it meant to have a 250,000 acres of kindling sticking up in the air, property owners hastened to get salvage logging underway. But there were a lot of these trees, and the lumber market could only handle so many logs at once. Every fire season came with a fresh set of fears for Oregon foresters. Conditions came up snake eyes in 1939, 6 years later, when another careless logging operation restarted the burn in nearly the same spot as before. By the time this fresh outbreak was done, it had ravaged more than 200,000 acres, mostly among the well-seasoned firewood of the previous burn, although 19,000 acres of fresh green timber was burned over as well. It happened again in 1945, 6 years after that. Two fires covering 182,000 acres, one of them possibly started by a Japanese balloon bomb. People started talking about a six-year jinx, and indeed 1951 brought with it another fire. But by comparison with the earlier ones, this one was puny at 32,000 acres, and it was the last one. At least a part of the reason the 1951 fire was the last one was the realization of a key insight that the fresh fires had made abundantly clear. The forests would have to be replanted. A single forest fire leaves seed cones behind ready to sprout and grow a new forest, but hit that same area with a second fire 6 years later, and you're left with a charred wasteland. It's a bit like reseeding your lawn in July and then forgetting to water it for a week. So in 1949, the state government launched a program to plant more than 72 million new trees in the ravaged landscape. By this time, most of the burned-over lands had escheated to the government for unpaid property taxes. In their podcast about the burn, Andy Lindberg and Doug Kent Crispin take the provocative position that except for the death and injuries resulting from it, the Tillamook burn was, on balance, a good thing. They may be right about that. As a result of the fire, vast tracts of privately owned forest became public lands, part of what today is the Tillamook State Forest. And further, the experience of reseeding those lands and the examples of what happened when they were not reseeded inspired many of the modern forestry laws and logging practices that protect us from similar catastrophes today. Catastrophes that, because of the state's higher population density today, would undoubtedly come with a considerably higher body count. Key sources in this story included works by Stuart Holbrook, Doug Decker, Doug Kent Crispin, and Andy Lindberg. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Offbeat Oregon, by the way, is a division of Pulplit Productions, a boutique publishing house about which more can be learned at pulp-lit.com. In addition to Offbeat Oregon books, podcasts, and audiobooks, we also publish book and audiobook versions of collections of what you might call street literature. 1920s pulp magazine writers like H.P. Lovecraft and Edgar Rice Burroughs, gothic penny dreadful titles like Sweeney Todd and The Adventures of Highwayman Dick Turpin, all straight shots of bottled-in bond working man's fiction and working women's fiction from the last couple of centuries. If that sounds like your jam, I'd love to have you check them out. That is pulp-lit.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.